What wins a Con Lion Award is not a Coca-Cola ad that says, buy one, get one free, and get your six back here, right? That's not what wins a Con Lion Award. What wins a Con Lion Award?
Hello, and welcome to episode 121 of Rockstar CMO FM. The M is for marketing, and the F is for whether you decide. As you're probably wondering, does the world need another effing marketing podcast? I'm your host, Ian Truscott. I'm no rockstar, but I picked up a thing or two over the last 20 years on my tour from techie to CMO and trusted advisor, and each week I chat to the true rockstars, my fabulous guests and chums, and share with you some marketing street knowledge that I hope will inspire your inner rockstar. Come say hello. We are Rockstar CMO on Twitter and LinkedIn, and proud members of the Marketing Podcast Network. This episode was recorded on Friday the 1st of July. I hope you've had a good week, and you are well, safe, and staying as sane as you feel you need to be. This week, my chum Jeff Clark and I chat about saying no. Rebecca Beeson, CMO of Reputation, returns to discuss the role of the CMO in corporate strategy. And I wind down the week in the Rockstar CMO virtual bar with my friend Robert Rose for a cocktail and a marketing thought. But first, we need to pay the bar tab. I'll be back in a moment.
We'll be right back.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Heiler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Time to welcome my chum, Jeff Clark, former Serious Decisions Forrester Research Director, as he answers the question, how to know when to say no. Welcome back, Jeff, to Rockstar CMO FM. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing very well on a sunny summer morning here in New England.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Well, that's good. We've got the we got the weather in fairly early doors, so that's good.
Is it sunny in Old England?
Yes, it is sunny in new parts of England too. But yes, it's sunny here. We have a bit of mixed weather, but right now the sun is beating down. We're due to have a very nice day today. So
awesome.
So that's wonderful. So that's got the weather sorted. So the last week we left the listeners with a bit of a gap, saying we don't really know what we're going to talk about next week. But since then, we decided that we're always telling our listeners what to do, constantly saying what to do. But this week, as you're going to take a little bit of a break, maybe leave us with what not to do, which sounds like it means doing something that marketers find quite difficult, which is to say no. So what say you, Jeff?
It is, one of the thoughts I had up on this is titling, how to know when to say no, which sounds very parental. No, you can't have that. And then you get the why. But it is, it was interesting. My wife and I, when we were traveling to Boston, and, we listened to podcasts when we got long drives. We listened to this podcast from the Hidden Brain, which was about the fact that just humans just have this really hard time eliminating things. So even when that's a solution to a problem, it's just we can't just take things away. So we're very good at inventing new things. We're very good at giving incentives for good behavior, but we don't get rid of the obstacles to good behavior. We collect new improved ideas, but we don't prune outdated ones. Mm-hmm. And I'm listening to this, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this sounds like what I used to counsel people in terms of marketing planning. It's like, you got to get to the point where it's like, what's working with your strategy? And let's talk about what's not working with your strategy. Yeah. And so the fellow who was interviewed in the book is called Subtract, The Untapped Science of Less. If anybody who is interested in digging more into the you know, the human nature aspects of this, but it just appears, you know, because I kept asking, well, why? So why is that? Why is that? And it just appears that we've evolved to, you know, avert loss, except if we're threatened, then we'll get rid of something. But otherwise, we just collect. We just try to go for new things.
Right. And you think, and I mean, I've not come across the Hidden Brain podcast. So what's that? Is that a psychology podcast?
Or? It's a psychology podcast. It's a guy who appears on our National Public Radio often, Chakravedante. So he'll dive into various things about really understanding. You might not understand why this happens. Well, let's get into psychology and find out why it happens.
So. That sounds fascinating. I'll include a link to that in the show notes, of course. But it sounds interesting that you've then taken that as to, well, that is definitely a challenge for marketing, isn't it? Because we're like little magpies, aren't we? We collect everything.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what sort of things do you then give advice on? Because I think, what are we talking about in terms of we're collecting? So quite often we collect processes, don't we, and tactics that we've always done.
Campaigns.
We
get in the habit of developing certain types of content. There's innumerable things that if you're not starting from scratch, it's like you're always looking at what we did in the past year. And we know it's a good practice to measure what was effective and things that were not effective, we should get off the plate. So that would be kind of part of the, you know, the test and, you know, sort of like fix things and then go again. But I think that the thing that's more, I think, as a basis of this for good is a good marketing planning process, because one of my favorite parts when we would go through a standard marketing planning process is to get to the point where, we call it kind of key actions, but it's basically, it's like, okay, now we've determined a strategy. You know, we know what the company strategy is. We know what marketing needs to do to support the company strategy. We've set goals. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the next thing is, you know, we should create a list of stuff that we do at a high level and say, what do we keep? What do we drop?
Right.
What do we fix? Because, you know, we might have had a campaign that just needs to be tweaked for a new audience, mm-hmm. or we have content that may need to be, you know, reoriented to a different decision maker. And what do we need to create new? Because, I mean, that's the thing is that, that was my experience. I think your experience at almost every company we've been at is that new strategy comes in. We've got new products, whatever, new audiences to go after.
Yeah.
So we create new things. But time is limited. So if you're going to create new things, what do you drop? Because, unless you've all of a sudden gotten, 100% more efficient, you can't really add a lot more to the plate.
But that's always the issue as well, isn't it? With executives coming into the marketing room or floor or office or whatever you've got, is they have these new ideas of new things that we need to do. And I think that we're often ill prepared to say, okay, so what are these things you want us to not do?
Yeah. Well, I think the thing is that's one of the reasons for doing a good planning process is because you can say, we used to counsel people to, summarize your plan on a piece of paper or slide or whatever. Yeah. And so it's pretty clear down to the basics, and you can say, okay, well, how does that fit this strategy? And you're right. I mean, there's the parochial interests of certain execs who are not aligned on maybe the company priorities or at least how marketing views is going to support those priorities. Yeah. There's staff who think that they may have their own strategy that's actually superior to what you all on the marketing leadership team agreed to. and then there's, as you said, there's people who are just comfortable doing what they've been doing. And when you get people who are in, whether it's event roles or digital marketing or, email, et cetera, they're kind of, on the hamster wheel we referred to last week. And they get a sense of what works probably from a tactical level, but they're not necessarily, looking at it from the strategic point of view and saying, okay, this might work on a tactical level, but is it actually supporting what we're trying to accomplish as an organization?
Right, right. And so is this a sort of a periodic thing somebody should do? So we're talking about the fact that something new comes up and therefore we reevaluate what we're doing already. But is this something that just marketing teams should just have a look at, check the relevance of all these things? And you've got here, you just said like keep, drop, fix or create new. Is that the kind of thing that you would say we'd need to do?
Well, I'd say certainly as part of an annual planning process is mm-hmm. when you're setting the goals for the year, you should do the high level iteration of, you know, keep, drop, fix, you know, or what are we creating new? One of the other things that, you know, we would often do in kind of workshops is like say, let's just create, here's what we're going to do and here's what we're not going to do. So we'll do, we'll not do list. And, you know, it could be, we're going to focus on these segments, you know, matter of fact, company I'm working with now, you know, we're focusing on law practices, government, schools. Okay. Mm-hmm. So therefore, what are you not going to focus on? Let's be explicit mm-hmm. about, okay, we're not going to mm-hmm. focus on manufacturing, retail, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You know, we got to fund a big conference coming up. Okay. So if the events team's going to be focused on that, then what do we like take them off of product launches or, you know, you know, analyst conferences that we used to go to. And so that's, I think, important in an annual planning process. And then if you're an organization that does it quarterly or, you know, biannual reviews, I think it's imperative to go back, you know, revisit the list. And particularly understand what's in the guise of what's working and what's not working and see, you know, did we make the right calls and do we need to, you know, make some adjustments? And maybe we need to add some things back. Maybe we got some pressure from, business unit leader. And of course, this is the thing that just is always a struggle is like, you know, if a business leader is saying, well, we need marketing to support something.
Yeah.
And you're going back and saying, well, how does this fit into the company strategy? Then you really need that should be starting a sort of a level of discussion that's at the executive level, not down at the tactical level. But the thing you want to avoid, you know, the thing that we always want to avoid is like somebody says, well, marketing's not supporting me. I'm going to hire my own marketer. And then the CMO gets pulled into we got to do this because otherwise they're going to hire their own person. And they're going to be off doing something different.
And I've been in exactly that situation with HR marketing.
It's a constant dub. But that's, again, that's why, you know, doing good, comprehensive annual planning gives you something to rest your foundation for your thought process.
Right. So an annual process, and I'm picturing in my mind that, you know, as a team, you're working out all the things that you will do, presumably against your personas, needs, all that kind of research we've talked about lots of times. And then you're listing a opposite of that. So if we're going to do this, then we won't do this. So we're going to focus here. We're not going to focus here. Now, when you do your reviewing, is there then another column? Because will is future. You look into the future. We will do this. We will not do this. Is there a view that you sort of review this and go, well, what actually happened?
Oh, well, absolutely. Because I think that has to be one of the inputs to this process so it might have been that, you know, if you're going after a new segment, but you're not going after, like I said, you may not go after retail or something like that. And it's mm-hmm. like, well, we always used to go to the National Retail Federation show and we did a great job. They're going to miss us. But if the organization has decided to put retail on the back burner, either get out of the market or put it on the back burner, it's good to know how well that worked and how that can apply to other events, but it's not, it is also good to just say, well, we're not going back to that event.
Right.
And any of the things were, by the way, I'm saying don't do is not that I'm saying that's a blanket, don't do them. I'm just saying,
In our theoretical situation.
And
what level do we look at with these things? I mean, that's the other interesting thing when I was thinking about this, as you were talking about it just now is, I mean, we're obviously going to talk about this is going to be like individual tactics and campaigns, correct? Right. But how far does this then ladder up into our strategy of what we will and will not do and how much what relationship does it have with that?
Well, I think that, you know, my personal perspective is that most marketing activity should fit in the context of a campaign. So a campaign mm-hmm. being a larger theme against a target audience might have multiple personas, might be one persona. but it's kind of the big themed work. And marketing may have, you know, several of these. And certainly if you're a large organization, you may have a dozen or so of these campaigns. And so there's usually campaign work, and then there's the sort of the shared services that support the rest of marketing, you know, creative services, PR, et cetera, brand. And so so if you can look at things at that high level of campaign, then it sort of says, well, everything that doesn't ladder up to that campaign, which somebody could actually falls into a splinter campaign or something like that. It's like that should just be cleared off the table. So that's where in the annual planning process, you kind of have to think of these things in the big chunks, not in the, you don't want to get down to the little weeds of saying, well, we're not going to send an email to the CIO anymore. Because that's just not a good, good exercise or good use of the marketing leadership teams.
Yeah. And I like this. I mean, I think it's a big challenge for marketers, particularly when you talk about targeting segments, supporting products, supporting use cases, because we're almost trained to widen that top of funnel as wide as we can. And saying no to something really goes against us. And not always there's somebody else in the business that says, no. In my market, in here, I want to go for manufacturers of, medical devices. That's my, and it's like, well, no, I'm sorry. It's a low priority segment for us.
And you may get salespeople, oftentimes there are salespeople who are tuned into a certain market segment and they may be off. I've certainly been in organizations where there's like somebody working federal government, but he's the only person working federal government.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, does marketing support them or not? And, you may get to the point where you say, we're just going to let that guy do his thing and wait until that becomes part of a larger strategic objective for the organization. And when that does, then we'll be ready to support them.
Yeah. I love this model. What I also like about this model from a content marketing perspective, which is how I view a lot of things, is when you're thinking about who you're talking to and who you're not talking to, that helps you sharpen up the copy and you're not so worried about the people that you're not talking to.
Yeah. You're talking to me. Yeah. Absolutely. I think the benefits of this are, it's like, you have more time to focus on what will actually deliver the right outcomes. The goals that you set, you want to make sure as much of the staff is aligned on the things that are going to help us hit that goal. They're not off doing things that are taking away from that. And then you get a consistency of message and execution, just like you're talking about. It's like, okay, we're trying to direct messages at these personas in these industries or these markets. Yeah. If we veer off that, then we're going to be inconsistent in how we're talking to the market. And that is never a good result.
No. I love this idea. And I really do like the idea of thinking about what you're not going to do, really, really focused. But it's quite difficult. I mean, when you've been talking to clients, what usually stands in their way?
I mean, it's. I think we go back to the top, human nature.
It's really,
it's just hard. And I remember even in an organization that we worked in, that I would go to the CMO and say, okay, so we've got this new campaign with these five different dimensions or five different sub campaigns. So what are we not doing? Because people are pretty tapped out and we're not hiring new people. So what are we not doing? And it's like, because sometimes that forces the CMO to have the discussion at a level that they don't want to have.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about that is, if you want to be crystal clear in the market about your five top things, then you need to stop talking about the other 12 fucking things you've been talking about all this time, right?
Yeah.
So it's not just a focus about the time you have as a marketing team to execute well, it's the time of your audience's attention, isn't it, that you're trying to focus as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
If you're sending out too many messages, you're confusing your customer base and your prospects.
Yeah. So you've got that executive who's then needs to have that go and have a difficult discussion. What other things do you think your clients need to face when they're talking about this stuff?
Well, I think that I mentioned a little bit about the fact that the staff, there are people who might be on staff that have their own ideas. I mean, this is kind of this is where planning becomes so important and communicating your plans, because as an organization gets, you know, everything like a marketing team gets beyond, I don't know, you know, say 15 people or something like that, it's just so hard to prevent them from people from straying off with their own ideas or, you know, again, what they were used to doing in the past that, you know, for them has worked. And, and so, you know, bringing people, you know, together and not just, you know, the leadership team doing a planning exercise, putting out a PowerPoint, saying we're done, you know, budgets are locked. Okay. You know, even though the budgets are locked and there might be an approval process, it's just too easy for things to stray. And so it really requires constant communication. So communicating, this is our strategy and this is what we're trying to accomplish. And this is specifically, you know, what we're not going to do, what we're fixing from last year, what we've need to create new, and then, you know, continuing in that process through the year, which is where quarterly, you know, quarterly reviewing of the planning cycles and the outcomes is just really important because that just keeps everybody in line. And that's also an opportunity when something new comes in, which I mean, most every company I've worked at, something mid-year just pops up and it's like, well, okay, that's our opportunity to go back to that original list and make sure we're clear about what we're going to go forward with and what we're going to stop doing.
Cool. I love it. I love it. And yes, and telling us how to say no and what we won't do, which is perfect. So for our final piece on the agenda, what song are you going to pick for this, Jeff?
You know, there's this theme that just rings in my ears when I hear this topic, and it's called Shout from Tears for Fears, 1985, you know, which is a classic. And, you know, these are the things I can do without. Come on, I'm talking to you, you know.
I like that. These are the things I can do without. Love it. Thank you very much, Jeff. So I'll be playing out with Shout, Tears of Fears, 1985. And when people spin the dial in this way, where are they going to find you, Jeff?
On LinkedIn and at Rockstar CMO Advisory as well.
Splendid. I know that you're off for a couple of weeks on holiday. So
see you again at the Ides of July.
In the Ides of July. Excellent. Thank you, mate. See you then.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Jeff, and that was, of course, the 80s classic Shout by Tears of Fears. And while Jeff will be taking a break for a couple of weeks, I'm delighted that Kathy McKnight will be stepping in. And please, if you have any feedback or suggestions for this slot, let us know. On to our guest. We welcome back Rebecca Beesman, the Chief Marketing Officer at Reputation, who's had a fabulous marketing career, holding B2B marketing leadership positions at Dialpad and RMS prior to Reputation. Before moving to B2B tech, Rebecca specialised in B2C marketing for CPG and retail, working for Earth Essentials and Gap. It's her third appearance on the show, and this week we talk about the role the CMO should play in corporate strategy. A great topic. Hope you enjoy this conversation. Welcome back, Rebecca, to Rockstar CMO FM. How are you?
I'm doing well. And you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much. I get to speak to you again. Which is always fun because you're a third time guest. We've had you, we first met you on episode 93, where we went through your career a little bit and chat to you about Reputation. And in 99, we talked about CSR, which is a fascinating topic. But for listeners of that are new to the show, maybe didn't hear those episodes, tell us a little bit about yourself and what Reputation do.
Sure. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I've been sort of vacillating across marketing and social impact for my career. The first 10 years were in B2C marketing for retail and CPG companies. The last 10 years have all been in B2B SaaS technology companies. And today I work for a company called Reputation. They're a feedback management platform for businesses. So they take all public feedback and private feedback, and they give companies actionable insights so that they can retain customers, acquire new customers. And that's what we do.
Yeah, the critical thing I think that we talk about as marketers right now, isn't it? Getting that feedback. And
yeah.
And you rebranded, didn't you, as Reputation. It's such a it's so on brand, isn't it, of what it is that, that you need. So as I mentioned just a moment ago, you came back on episode 99 and we talked about CSR programs, which was a fascinating topic, and I encourage people to go back and listen to that again. And this episode, you're bringing to us the marketing department as the central command for corporate strategy.
Yep.
So when we talked about this before I hit record, I was fascinated, so I had to have you back. So I love this. So can I start with one question? What do you mean by the central command for corporate strategy?
Sure. I think that more and more brand and the work that a company does around its positioning, messaging, North Star, is central and completely intertwined with having a clear and enduring corporate strategy. So that's what I mean. I think they're converging and it's becoming one and the same. And so because of that, the marketing team is sort of organically becoming the center of that conversation. Often they're the instigators of the work. They're certainly the ones who are responsible for executing all the cascading output that comes out of that work. And so I think that's a real paradigm shift that's taken place over the last several years with marketing teams.
Right. And the thing, I mean, we marketers, right, we tend to get called in at the tail end. So a strategy is defined by a bunch of people in the C-suite, or a product is created and marketing is told to just go market that. This is what we want. Let's go market that. What do you think is changing here? Because clearly what you mean by the central command for corporate strategy is really the leadership team getting together with marketing and defining this. And you're talking about brand being at the center of that. So is that what we're talking about as a concept?
Absolutely. I think that brand and the way that we talk about brand is just a personification or an output of the core corporate strategy. And so you can't have a great brand without having a very clearly defined corporate strategy. And that's what I mean by them almost being interchangeable at this point.
Yeah.
Who starts the work and instigate that process? To your point, sometimes it's the chief strategy officer. Sometimes it's the CEO or the CFO. Sometimes it's the chief marketing officer or the head of the marketing team coming in and saying, look, we need to codify and make very clear who we are, what we do, how we do it better than everyone else, and why it matters. And those central brand questions are also completely relevant to a strong corporate strategy. So the lines have blurred. And to your point, it takes a true cross-functional effort to make it happen. It's not a marketing exercise in a silo.
Right. But I think marketing brings some skills here, right, to this particular discussion. So what do you see? Why do you think marketing should be at the center of this rather than just the execution people that need to make it happen?
Yeah, I think it's twofold. I mean, the power of marketing is taking complex or vague, ambiguous ideas and concepts and really distilling them and making them concrete to a wide variety of stakeholders. That's what great marketing looks like. So it's one thing to sit in a room in isolation and do corporate strategy work. It's another thing to have that strategy be translatable to your employees, to prospective customers, current customers, to the market at large. That is marketing's job. That's what we're great at. And that's why it is imperative for marketing to be in the conversations at the beginning, if not leading those conversations. We're like the translator for corporate strategy. And then to your point, marketing is also going to be the arm of the business that's responsible for the tactical output of that work. Mm-hmm. So there, what you don't want is a disconnect between a great strategy and the way that it looks out in the market. And if marketing isn't central to the conversation from the very beginning, you run the risk of that happening almost like a bifurcated approach where marketing has to sort of translate this strategy into something usable. That's not what you want. You want it to be fluid and holistic across that process.
Yeah, like being handed a product and make this useful in the market, right? Yeah. And also, I think because marketing, we have the data, right? And we have the insight and we have the connection to the customers. Do you think that's also valuable in developing this sort of strategy, this corporate strategy?
Yes, absolutely I do. I think that not only does marketing have the analytics to support the strategy, and perhaps marketing isn't the only team at the company who has those insights. There might be other teams that bring great data. But one of the things that marketing is able to do is translate and distill data in a way that can create, again, like actionable output for this strategy to come to life. So that is a unique skill set that marketers have that I think is incredibly important to this project. And you made a really good point when you talked about sort of a product being thrown at you as a marketing team, sort of other things happening on the R&D side of the house. A strong and coherent corporate strategy should be that North Star and that starting point through which everything else cascades. And that should include the product roadmap. That should include the brand outreach exercise. And so not only are you getting this great sort of top of the pyramid, everything coming out of that should be more intertwined than it ever has before. That should make cross-functional work, strategic planning, roadmap planning, all of that should become easier, because one of the things that a great corporate strategy and a great brand does is not only tell the world who you are, it also makes it very clear who you're not. And often in startups and late stage startups, it feels like the world is your oyster and you can go so many different directions and you can be everything to everyone because you really can be, and you're not quite sure who you are yet.
Yeah.
And so focus is the biggest challenge that many companies earlier on in their trajectory need to surmount in order to get to scale. And corporate strategy or brand work can really help focus a company and rally a company around the tent poles that are going to be important and enduring as the company continues to grow.
Yeah, I like that view, because are you saying that, I mean, this sounds like something that everybody should be doing, not just startups, but it sounds to me like you're saying as a startup, you've got to try some things, but this has quickly got to solidify into, you know, here's who we are, here's who we're not, and this is how we're going to move forward. And that's a collection of all the leadership team coming up with that plan, and that product development falls into that lockstep as well as marketing and branding, right?
Yeah. And I think experimentation is great. I think that that should never stop, no matter what company size or stage that you are. At some point, though, as a company gets from growth to scale, you have to be able to focus your efforts and your energy as a business while still, again, siphoning off or siloing experiments to see how you're going to continue to grow and scale. And I think especially for employees, current prospective customers, it's really important for them to understand who you are, because it makes everything fall into place. It just reduces friction in the system.
I like that. And I think that expressing who you are is the important part, isn't it? Right. Because, you know, one of the things I was going to ask you there about, you know, the challenge for marketers, isn't it, is that the term branding has kind of has been made a bit soft. There's this idea that it's just about the colors, and, you know, people are always taking the piss out of us about the crayons and the unicorn department, right? Rather than that strategy and brand are so tightly linked, and it is the definition of who we are. Is that your experience? I mean, how have you experienced this? Is that something you've needed to break into, or has that come naturally?
I think, to your point, the verbal and visual identity of the brand is the output of all of the work that gets done up front. So there should absolutely be alignment between the two. One, you know, the latter comes out of the former. If you have a great brand identity and you understand the message to the market, you understand who you are, you understand who you're not, all of that should flow, again, pretty organically, but that's the output. That's sort of the tactical representation of the really hard work that has to get done up front. And the really hard work isn't just marketing in a silo, nor really is the tactical execution piece. It requires a lot of different teams within the company to help make it happen. But certainly marketing has the lion's share of that output piece. The inputs into that work that's coming out should be very holistic across the executive team. And for a couple of reasons. Number one, diversity of opinion always matters and always makes anything better. The second is you need their buy-in, because the way that great brands get codified, it's not by having the perfect messaging. It's by the consistency in the output. It's a discipline. So you all have to hold hands and you have to align. And everywhere you look, the brand has to be consistent. And so in order to do that really effectively, you're going to need really cross-functional buy-in from the very beginning, because you can't have certain teams within the business representing the brand in different ways. That's the surest way to dilute the impact of that brand.
Absolutely. I feel a bit lazy by saying Apple at this point, but what you just described just then, you can't help but think Apple with what you've just said. And of course, that was driven by, you know, one, you know, sort of visionary that looked across this, and I'm assuming that obviously that organizations need to change and that has that. And is that what you're talking about there, that every execution, customer touch point, brand, asset, product even, subscribes to what this is that we've come up with as a corporate strategy?
Absolutely. And yeah. Again, it doesn't mean that there's not place for experimentation. It doesn't mean that brands don't continue to evolve and rev.
Yeah.
All of those things can be true while still having complete consistency around the output and representation of that brand. And that's why it's a discipline, because it's not an easy thing to do. It's an easy thing to say. And the companies who end up having the best brands are often those that are the most deeply committed to that brand output and are the most consistent around it. And it doesn't mean that it was the best designed logo that ever occurred. It doesn't mean it's the best slogan to ever be out there in the market. It just means that it's extensible, it's repeatable, and it's consistent. And that's ultimately what's going to get them that credibility.
Yeah, that consistency, absolutely, across it. Now, I took the lazy example, which was Apple, right? Where have you seen this done really well?
I think that often, and we talked about this a little bit before, one of my last appearances, B2B is generally the laggards in great plans. And that's just the truth of it. And so I do think B2B is getting better, but most of the great brands out there really are B2C brands. And one of the things that I love to talk about with brand, it's not just the output of it, you know, Nike, Apple, sure, there are always those perennial leaders. But the brands who I think are really interesting today are using brand as an ethos. And that, I think, is such an interesting way to have brand be the personification of the company.
So
I think about brands like Patagonia, which is a clothing brand based in the US, or even Ben & Jerry's ice cream. And they've been able to take something sort of tangentially related to the work that they do and almost personify the brand's personality in a way to where it cascades throughout the business model. I think that is so interesting because, again, that's taking brand so far out of a marketing silo. And it's saying everything from the way we package, to the way we price, to the way that we do product development, to the way that we show ourselves to the market is all completely tied back to this idea of who we are and our North Star as a brand.
Yeah, I love that I love the word there, ethos. I say love a lot, but I love what you've just said. But I love that word ethos. Think North Star, ethos. These things you're talking about is the thing that we all collect around, right? And we hope our tribe and our customers also collect around, right? Is that, and do you think there's an opportunity for B2B to do that? Because there's a bit of a backlash at the moment against organizations that are too focused on causes and stuff like that. Do you think B2B brands do have an opportunity in our little stuffy world to stand for something and have that ethos?
I absolutely do. And it can be completely apolitical. It doesn't need, you know, these are two examples where, you know, it leans towards the political, but again, that's B2C. B2B is a totally different context. And I think one of the places where B2B lags is actually in that tactical output of the brand. There's a lot of really great B2B brands that have sort of clear purposes, really well-defined messaging in the market, but they look like a B2B brand.
They're not relatable.
They're not emotional. And it's like, that's where I think B2B can actually evolve, because the blur between people's business lives and personal lives is already happening. So your B2B buyer, they're a consumer in so many other parts of their life. And like I said, the lines between those two things and how you reach that audience, how that buyer wants to buy today versus how they acted and interfaced with those B2B brands 10 years ago, it's completely transformed. And I think brand needs to catch up to some of that.
And I mean, I like the way this conversation has moved, because we're now talking about human to human, aren't we? We're talking about the B2B doesn't need to be boring. It doesn't need to be dull. Is that, you know, there's an emotional decision that somebody's making in purchasing your software. So they need to have some of the feels about who you are, right? And also what I quite like about this kind of conversation is it often identifies who is for you and who isn't for you, right? So to back to your point you were making much earlier about focus, I think if you can be really clear about who you are and who your people are, then you can be really clear about who you're not and who your people aren't, right?
Yeah, it'll just make your marketing better. It'll make it more succinct and more impactful. I mean, ICP is so important, and really understanding who you're marketing to, what the problem is that you're solving for the people that you're marketing to and how to message that appropriately to those people is literally the key to unlock if you are a B2B marketer. And to your point, it all stems from a focused brand. Without it, you're going to have a marketing team that's trying to do too much. And when you try to do too much, you end up, it's very hard to do things well when you're trying to do too much.
Yeah. I love that. Not all organizations, how do I put this? Not all organizations are quite this enlightened, right? We've talked about examples where marketing teams get handed a strategy or a product and said, go make that famous, right? What's your recommendation for CMOs that are looking to play more of a role in the C-suite in the sort of the development of strategy?
I think language is so important when having these conversations or instigating some of this. And so when I talk about brand, I mostly use the words corporate strategy. Yeah. I very rarely use the words brand, even in the rebrand or brand refresh exercises that I've done. And when we do them, it's always with the entire executive team. It's always grounded in corporate strategy. When we talk about North Star, we talk about the strategic pillars for the business coming out of the North Star. It's all about the language that you use and how you frame it to the other stakeholders. Yeah. Because to your point, you need their buy-in. You need their alignment, and you actually need their participation in the exercise for the best outcome. So that would be one thing I would recommend, is thinking really critically about the language and how you're marketing the branding.
I think that's excellent advice. I think you're completely right. Sadly, the term brand has been tainted, hasn't it? And also, when you're in that environment, you don't want to be the lead marketer who's just representing marketing. You want to be part of that strategic group who's bringing ideas and insight and stuff, and seen as developing strategy, not developing brand, not developing the latest kind of blue our B2B company that's needs right. to be, right?
Yeah,
absolutely. We're fully focused. Well, that's excellent. I'm going to, I've just looked at the time. Good Lord. I'm going to lead to our final question. It's the same final question, you're very familiar with it. When we first met you in episode 93, I asked you what you'd like to throw into our Rockstar CMO swimming pool, our portal to hell for all the bullshit, snake oil and overhyped trends from this industry we love. You suggested the pressure on CMOs to be social influencers, which I loved. I've used that love word again. I wrote a post about it, really enjoyed it, and definitely went in the pool. So at the moment, I'm asking all my return guests, any regrets on that choice or something else you'd like to toss in there?
Oh, I have no regrets. I still belong in the deep end of the pool. And for my colleagues who are great social influencers, more power to you. I just don't think that needs to be a prerequisite to amazing CMOs out there who are doing great work. So.
Yeah. And I think I can conclude the post with your quote, which is let the work do the talking, right? That's what it should be. So that's excellent. Thank you very much. And so when the listeners spin the dial on the interwebs, where are they going to find you and where are they going to find Reputation?
Yep. Both on LinkedIn. They're great places. Follow Reputation. The company page is there. And then I'm Rebecca Beastman at LinkedIn. Happy to connect and chat more about these topics.
Splendid. And I will again include all your links in the show notes. Thank you very much, Rebecca.
Thank you.
And I'll speak to you soon.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Rebecca. Always fun to catch up. Food for thought there. Let us know what you think. If you're a CMO, do you have a seat at the strategy table? I will, of course, include all her links in the show notes. Right. It's Friday evening. Time to wind down in the Rockstar CMO virtual bar and find my friend and content marketing guru, Robert Rose, Chief Troublemaker at the Content Advisory, for a cocktail and a marketing thought. Good evening, Robert. What are you drinking?
Oh, hello, my friend, and welcome to the bar, the end of the bar, and if I do say so, a bit of a special week.
Yes.
I don't know why. I don't know what could possibly be.
Can I say?
Please do.
Happy birthday, Robert.
thank you very much. Yes, indeed. And so this week in the bar, we have, I basically made the drink that I want to drink. too bad if nobody else likes it. And as you know, certainly, and some of your listeners may know, the more frequent listeners, I am a big fan of the very simple, the simpler the drink, the better for me. And I have discovered this wonderful, well, I don't know that I've discovered. I certainly didn't discover it. It existed well before I knew about it. But I have personally discovered the tequila that is my new favorite when I want to drink something really, really fancy and really, really nice. It is the Casa Dragones. So that's House of Dragons, if you're translating from Spanish. Yes. Casa Dragones. It's an extra Añejo. It is like one of the finest scotches you'll ever drink. It's just absolutely smooth and beautiful and wonderful. And we're going to have that with nothing else in it. We're going to have it just very straight, very simple. We're not even going to put a rock in it. We're just going to cool it. We're going to pull it out of a refrigerator where it's been cooling for some time. We're going to pour it into a glass, wait for it to come to room temperature, and then enjoy. And that is our cocktail for this evening.
And do you think that's why that there's this mariachi band coming in to wish you happy birthday?
Ah, well, there you go.
I wasn't going to
go down that road, but since you are the man to create work for yourself, yes, there you go. Here is your mariachi band coming in to play music. And thank you for celebrating this on my birthday. I really appreciate bringing in the band.
Absolutely. What would be the virtual bar without remembering your birthday? Well, I'll attempt to make this complicated drink that you've just made. I've just put in two biggish rocks into my glass. Oh, using the ingredients on my desktop bar. I love the sound of that tequila, but I'm going to go with the most English of tequilas, Hendrick's Gin.
Ah, yes.
A little bit of...
Yes, it's not only the wrong liquor, it's the wrong color, it's the wrong everything. It's just, it just couldn't be more wrong. But, you know, nothing like being wrong.
Guess what, how I'm going to make it even wronger now.
Yeah, that's right. With
a little bit of... I'm not even replacing an ingredient because you've only got one ingredient in yours, but I'm going to put a splash of Fever Tree Cucumber Tonic Water in there. Let me give this a taste and wish you a very happy birthday. That is delicious, Robert. I could drink one of these every week. Well, happy birthday.
Well, thank you very much. That's lovely for you to say. And yes, indeed.
So... you're being completely selfish, as you should be, and by we're having the drink that you want, where would you like to take us?
Well, I think we have to go to one of my favorite places where I like to relax, and that is, of course, you know, probably, you know, we've never done the statistics on all the places that we've been over the number of episodes. It would be fun to do a map at some point.
Yeah.
Basically, anywhere on a beach is always good for me. And so I thought we'd head to Tulum, where is one of my favorite beaches in Mexico. And and of course, a little touristy these days, but you can just go outside of Tulum and there are some wonderful places to actually go and really, really explore and find just that very good place on the beach to settle in, have a tequila, and some really good Mexican food, yes.
Oh, man, that sounds perfect. I'm there. Absolutely, man. That sounds fantastic.
And to cool off a little bit, it's ungodly hot here in Southern California right now. So,
Good. All right. And, you know, it wouldn't be your birthday without a conversation about marketing. So what is it that we'd be talking about in this beautiful Mexican resort?
Well, I didn't design it this way by for sure, but I think there's an interesting... chat to have. It was actually something you sent me, which was a lovely way to get an idea for something to write about and to think about. And it's this concept of, is being good in the world a killer for growth? Yeah. And where it comes from is this, the speech. It's a recent, so at Viva Tech, which I didn't even know was a thing, but apparently is a thing, Viva Tech in France.
Yeah.
It's a conference for startups, as I understand it, for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And so Mark Pritchard, who is the chief brand officer at Procter & Gamble, and seemingly perennially on a stage somewhere at a marketing conference, he actually... he was being interviewed on the stage at Viva Tech and one of the things they were talking about was this idea of have brands over-indexed or swung the pendulum too hard to messaging around doing good for the planet, in other words, doing good, or doing or focusing on growth, you know, growth marketing, basically, in their messaging. And The Drum, ultimately, you know, a publication that I frequently have disagreements with, but in this particular case, The Drum reported on that particular speech, and also included an open letter from a Unilever investor, which was last year or the year before, that was lamenting Unilever's growth over the last couple of years, and basically said in their open letter to investors that Unilever had become obsessed with publicly displaying sustainability credentials. In other words, really focusing in on doing good messaging rather than, as they said, at the expense of focusing on the fundamentals of the business or growth advertising. And anyway, after all of that, I went and watched Pritchard's talk and read the open letter. And the problem is that so Mark's talk is much more nuanced than The Drum's article makes it out to be.
Yeah.
What he says is that P&G sees there's an area for growth, meaning business growth, and an area for good, meaning doing good things in the world. And he looks at it, and P&G looks at it as a virtuous cycle. They balance each other out. And I agree with that 100%. They are a virtuous cycle. They are a balance in terms of you know, where we spend time and effort and money and all those kinds of things. However, P&G sees additionally, and Mark says in his thing, brands and businesses being a force for growth and a force for good. But he added, the order matters. And that's where I disagree. Because saying that companies have over-leveraged this purpose-driven content or purpose-driven marketing or doing good in the world as a messaging and growth is, it lends itself to a suggestion that those two things are opposites on a spectrum.
Right.
In other words, you can do one or the other, but not both. And you have to rebalance for both. And you can find plenty of companies out there that have done a bad job of doing purpose-led initiatives, right? You know, like, ooh, that's just like, you know, that was cringeworthy.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that if they swung the pendulum back to doing buy now or here's a discount for your coupon, that all of a sudden that problem would go away. And vice versa, there's tons of brands that have done horrible jobs at growth marketing, discounting, et cetera. And that doesn't mean that swinging the pendulum back to, you know, showing why their, you know, their detergent helps the planet is going to help them differentiate in any way.
Yeah.
And so those two things are balanced, but they're not opposite ends of the spectrum here. And that's the real key when we have to think through this, because the challenge and the reason that this matters to get straight is because what we see a lot in businesses these days is content marketing, which is often at the heart of doing these sustainability or purpose-driven types of content efforts, often is seen as the opposite end of direct marketing or growth marketing.
Yeah.
And too many times I hear from a VP of marketing at a tech company, for example, they say, oh, we're going to cut our content marketing and education program because we need to focus on lower in the funnel. And it's like, no, that's the best way to strangle your lead generation program, right?
Yeah.
And so it's really understanding that these two things are not opposite ends of a spectrum, but rather we have to do both effectively. Growth is a focus on strategy, but growth of what? Marketing, revenue, profitability, market share. Each of those are elements of a spectrum, right? Good is the how we would differentiate in that spectrum. And, you know, you can pull a lever hard or pull a lever soft, but it's that they are not opposite ends of the same spectrum. And so it's just really critically important to understand that.
Yeah, and I think part of the problem is there's no nuance in it, and it had a bit of Ritson about it. I thought, I know it's The Drum and not Marketing Week, but it sort of felt a bit like something, you know, like that extreme view that he would take. But I feel that it's really about the audience, isn't it? I mean, if you're at content marketing and your storytelling, and you want to engage your audience, if this is relevant and it's relevant to your brand, it's relevant to them, then tell that story about, you know, how your impact on the planet or one of your social causes or whatever it is. But if it's completely off brand and not who you are, it's going to come off as completely a fake, isn't it? So it's that authenticity thing, isn't it?
Well, that's a really important point, because the way the article positions it, the immediate reaction you have is, what they're saying is that audiences, generally speaking, have a fatigue.
Yeah.
And there actually is research, because I've seen it, research mm-hmm. that shows to a certain extent audiences do have a fatigue on brands purporting to do good things for the planet as part of their main mission. But I would counter and say it's not that they're turning away from those ads from an attention or a, you know, convertibility or whatever you want to look at as your metric in terms of the idea that the brand itself is telling a story that it is good for the planet or, you know, good for sustainability or whatever it is that it's done poorly. Yeah. In other words, that the fatigue is against doing things in a crappy way, not necessarily the fact that you're doing the thing.
Yeah.
And I would point to brands that are doing it very well, you know, like REI is a great example, who had their biggest growth ever in 2021. And they lean, I mean, their entire story around growing is around what they do for the planet.
Yeah.
And so it shows you that you can do both well. In other words, you can drive great growth, even in trying economic times, as you use doing good for the planet as a differentiator. Yeah. And regardless of the general zeitgeist of fatigue out in the audience, you can still affect your strategy if you do it well. And that's where understanding, just to your point, understanding your audience and what it is you're trying to do and the limits of what you can do is such an important thing. So it is all about understanding the entirety of your marketing strategy, not how you're swinging one lever between two ends of a spectrum.
Yeah, yeah. Because I think that some of that reaction, isn't it, in Adland is about the fact that, you know, your metro, the stereotypical city-based agency are more focused on these causes than they are actually on selling product is the argument, isn't it? And also, I mean, I just read something about Cannes Lions, or Cannes Lions, or whatever you say, that most of the 30 that won, there was some cause around the campaign that attracted the judges' attention. So there's a lot of that hype going on, isn't there?
Of course. Yeah. And I mean, you know, that's been the, you know, I mean, it's been a little while since we've seen Cannes Lions because they've been offline for literally 2 years, but you know, and it's easy to see how quickly we forget that, you know, it's always, you know, the ones that win are always the, you know, sort of things that have nothing to do with growth, right? You know,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
What wins a Cannes Lion Award is not a Coca-Cola ad that says, buy one, get one free and get your six pack here, right? That's not what wins a Cannes Lion Award. What wins a Cannes Lion Award is when you bring in some famous movie star and do something about the effects of sustainability of how, you know, the earth is changing, and you've got this beautiful story of, you know, almost telling the Avatar type story of Coca-Cola, right? It's not what win a Cannes Lion Award. And arguably should, right? I mean, because that's where innovation in the medium is happening. But to look at those two things as ends of a spectrum would be a mistake, right? Because of course they do both. Of course Coca-Cola or, you know, P&G or Unilever do both. And it's, you know, there is a balance, no doubt, but the focus is on doing both well, not any one of them as a adjunct to the other.
Yeah, no, I love it. I love it. And I think that there's too much, isn't it? It's what grabs marketing headlines, isn't it? That you take a position against something and it's one or the other thing, and it really ought to be a more nuanced.
Well, sure. I mean, the Drum article is simply just clickbait. I mean, it's just a clickbait article to get you to, you know, because, I mean, by the way, he spends, you know, the whole 20-minute talk of Pritchard is worth a view, and it's available online. You can go watch it. I mean, his, you know, he ends actually and spends a great deal of time, you know, and it's kind of actually a shame because the interviewer doesn't literally you know, I mean, the interviewer clearly has an agenda that he wants to talk about too. And, yeah. you know, I could go on a rant about that, but I won't. But Pritchard actually does a fantastic job, as he usually does, mm-hmm. of outlining the fact that it's about the basics. It's about, yeah. It's about getting back to the basics when yeah. it comes to marketing in difficult times yeah. and really understanding your customer and being able to deliver the superior experience, no matter what it is. And so yeah. it's the talk is worth a you know, but you would lose that if you just went to the clickbaity yeah. article.
Well, apologies for sending you clickbait. Yeah,
that's right. Well, but you know, you have a special insight into what, like, you know, as Peter Griffin from Family Guy might say, what grinds my gears, right?
Yeah. All right. So apologies for that on your birthday. But I'll include a link to that in the show notes. But also you said that you'd also written about it. So whereabouts have you written about it, Robert?
Well, the latest place that I've written about this would be Content Marketing Institute, which, mm-hmm. of course, you can get to with contentmarketinginstitute.com and all of that. But... Yeah. If yes. you are more interested in things like this that we talk about, you can see that on my own little website, which is contentadvisory.net.
Splendid. And how's your other project going that we mentioned last week?
My other project is going very well, and thank you for becoming part of the community as well. So yes. For anybody who's out there thinking about, you know, if you work for an agency, or if you are, you know, you advise clients either internally or externally on customer experience, storytelling, and content, our community, experienceadvisors.io, is up and running and would love to have your application to be a member. It's not some big application process, not a big velvet rope or a bouncer sitting out front, but we're just trying to keep the place, you know, orderly, as it were. So we're accepting applications now, and we process them every Friday. So experienceadvisors.io if you want to go there.
Splendid. And I look forward to seeing all the listeners on Discord.
There we go.
All right, mate. Thank you very much. So when we spin the dial on the interwebs, where else can we find you?
You'll find me all over the place on the social media things. As uh-huh. you know, I'm enjoying Twitter, and with the announcement of Twitter's new long form content, I'm very interested to see yes. how that turns around.
I am as well, I think, as well. Yes, that sounds good. And also the reason for, you know, keeping people on the platform and stuff. All good. Yeah. Perhaps we should have added that to the thing. But most importantly, mate, will you be in the bar next week? After
I will absolutely be here next week, yes.
All right. I look forward to it. Cheers, mate.
Cheers.
Thank you, Robert. Splendid rant there. What do you think? Do you think we're all obsessed with purpose? So that's a wrap on episode 121 of the Rockstar CMO Effing Marketing Podcast. I've been your host, Ian Truscott. Thanks again to Jeff, Rebecca, and Robert for sharing their insight. Please say hello to them. I'll include all their links in the show notes, which you can find on your favorite podcast app or at rockstarcmo.com, where you can also find all our previous episodes. But most of all, thank you for dropping a dime into your podcasting jukebox, selecting our track, and jiving along with us. So... does the world need another Effing Marketing Podcast? Let us know on the socials, or drop a rating or review in your favourite podcast app. Or just keep listening. I'm glad you're here. Next week, while Jeff takes a break, Kathy McKnight will be back. Looking forward to that. My guest will be James Scherer, VP of Growth at Codeless. And Robert will be back in the bar. Until then, have a great week. And if you're in the US, enjoy your independence. As you've noticed, self-governing is quite hard. And I hope you again join us back here next week on Rockstar CMO FM.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.